Watch your DVR Nevada Newsmakers Saturday and Sunday mornings from 5:30 to 6:30 on Cox Cable Channel 12 or Dish and Direct TV Channel 21 or anytime at NevadaNewsmakers.com.
I'm Jeff Gehrman, an investigative reporter with the Las Vegas Review-Journal. I'm your guide for season two of Mobbed Up, The Fight for Las Vegas.
You're in with every gangster and hoodlum in the United States.
I don't go for that, Mr. Kennedy. I don't go for that kind of action.
I was on television accused of fronting for the mob.
Subscribe to Mobbed Up, The Fight for Las Vegas, Season 2, today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And, you know, I pity the judge who has to wade through all of this and take court time away from, you know, other legitimate civil disputes that need to be adjudicated.
From the Las Vegas Review-Journal, this is RJ Politics.
Hello and welcome to RJ Politics, the Las Vegas Review-Journal's weekly political podcast. I'm politics reporter Rory Appleton.
And I am politics and government editor Steve Sebelius.
Got a couple topics to talk about, things I've been writing about this last week or so. We are going to eventually get into some of the challengers in the 3rd Congressional District. I was able to interview a couple of them in this last week or so after I was out for about 10 days with COVID after getting vaccinated and everything, but that's another show. But first thing that we want to talk about is what I've been working on all this week, what we've been talking about all this week, which is basically total chaos at the Clark County Republican Party. Last week, there was an attempt at a meeting to elect new officers. Depending on who you ask, it was either, you know, accosted by some ruffians outside, or the existing board did not allow a lot of duly elected and happy members and things like that inside to participate in the election. It depends entirely on who you ask. Essentially, the whole thing has just sort of spiraled out. New officers were not elected. The meeting was adjourned. The chairman, Dave Sajak, who was about to term limit out anyway, resigned. And now you've essentially had, since then, earlier this week, I guess just on Wednesday of this week, a fringe group, basically a group of, they say, about 50 or so Central Committee members met to elect a new chairman. They say they did it. They say they elected Jesse Law, who used to work for the state party here and for the Trump White House and Trump campaign here. But the existing board didn't recognize the meeting, says they're still in charge, says the meeting's not actually going to adjourn until August 17th, says that Law is not able to run for office because his membership has been suspended for a number of reasons. And essentially what you've now got is the true, almost kind of farcical experience of, as best as I can tell, as we're recording this on Thursday of this week, there are two competing boards. One of which is the, you know, sort of the holdover board that's been the board for a while that still has the keys to the office and the bank accounts and everything. The other is this new sort of upstart kind of board that was elected this week with the deep, deep support of the state party chairman, who, as we've talked about in previous shows, doesn't get along with the county party and hasn't for years anyway. So essentially, I mean, the way to wrap this up is nothing's been decided and we're almost certainly going to court.
Yeah, no, it definitely seems that way. And, you know, I pity the judge who has to wade through all of this and take court time away from, you know, other legitimate civil disputes that need to be adjudicated to adjudicate this this sort of party in exile. You're having two competing factions saying, no, we're the legitimate government of the Republican Party. And the other guy is the, you know, exile government or whatever, the rump government. And it's kind of sad, but, you know, it's nothing new. I remember, you know, going to Republican county party events and state party events, you know, years and years ago, as a young reporter, and they would degenerate almost immediately from the start into shouting and name calling and threats to sue one another. It was just a complete mess. Even back then, held in places like the Showboat. This tells you how long ago these meetings that I'm talking about were held, because that Showboat doesn't exist anymore. It's an empty lot. And the Republican Party has essentially been the same for a long time. Now, the Democratic Party is not that much better. These county party events draw the true believers, the base of the party, and people who really have probably better things to do, but choose to do this anyway on weeknights to go and form this party. And it's just sad, because it raises the question in the minds of people who are regular folks, civilians, if you will, who are not members of the Central Committee, but members of the party, registered members of the party, who wonder, hey, these guys can't seem to run a party. It reminds me, once years ago, there was a Tea Party rally in the great town of Searchlight. They decided to hold it in Searchlight to be right near Harry Reid's house and yell loud enough for Reid to hear them and all that. And it was this big, giant sort of a culvert that they had taken over, and it became the conservative Woodstock. There was a stage set up. There were vendors. There were little other areas and whatnot. And a few friends of mine unwisely chose to pile into a Prius and attend amongst the throngs of off-road vehicles and Ford F-150s. It took us a long time to get into this area, but an even longer time to get out. Prompting one of the members of our group to remark that if the Tea Partiers ran the government the way they ran a parking lot, we would all be much worse off than with the current government, which I believe at the time was Barack Obama. So there's a matter of competence here, and a matter of trust that the party is going to ask people for donations so that they can turn out voters and register voters and all of that. And when voters see this kind of mess, I think they're rightly skeptical as to whether or not those donations are rightly placed in the hands of folks who, you know, at this point can't agree on who the actual chairman of the party is or should be. And I think that's it's really something remarkable. But again, nothing surprisingly new.
Yeah, absolutely. And you brought up a good point that for the hundreds of rank and file, probably thousands, who are sort of rank and file members. They're not necessarily on the Central Committee, though many of them are. I think there's something like 400 or something like that Central Committee members from Clark County, in Clark County. There are a lot of them who are not part of either of these sort of warring factions, which ultimately, and this is probably an oversimplification, ultimately it's the former chairman, Dave Sajak, and his sort of ilk and group, including the current or depending on who you ask, former board, and then Michael McDonald, who's the chair of the state party. I mean, those two have been at each other for as long as Sajak was chair, as long as I've been here for sure, and probably for years before that, since they've both been around for a long time. There are a lot of people who don't fall into that, who just are Republicans. They want to be members of the party, and that party specifically does require you to attend meetings. I mean, you have to. If you miss two meetings in a row, you can be removed, and then you're not allowed to participate in sort of party business and things like that as well. So there are a lot of people, as these kind of rogue and rival meetings are happening. I have heard, from reporters that we've had at these events, which was, sort of a fake meeting that happened months ago, from people who went, from other people who were sort of, kept outside and stuff like that. I've heard that there are plenty of people who are there who are just like, look, I don't know if this is the real meeting. I just want to show up, listen to what's going on in the party, not get thrown out, and then go home. I don't care about all this mess and who's in charge and stuff like that. And it certainly bears sort of, mentioning the fact that we're very much, even though this is an off year, there's not an election, we are very much in campaign season. I mean, there are several Republicans who are actively campaigning for governor, which is, you know, obviously a very, very important race to that party this upcoming cycle. It's really an important race to the whole country. It's a nationwide sort of race. And there are at least two Republicans who have filed and had launch events for Senate. And, you know, the anticipation is that Adam Laxalt will announce somewhat soon or maybe not. But there's at least two Republicans running there. And as we're going to talk about in a little bit, there's plenty of Republicans who's announced for Congress and for lower races who are actively campaigning. And I've heard from several sort of political consultants around here that their basic view of it is we can't rely on the party for anything. We're going to have to do this all ourselves. We can't rely on the sort of foundational support that we get from the party, you know, big, large sort of mailing lists that they can use, you know, voter registration information, general attempts to register more voters and raise money and use it for events that help all Republicans and things like that. They're basically saying we can't rely on them at all. We're going to have to, you know, do this on our own for a while. And this has been happening for months now. I mean, this is the second consecutive meeting that has been kind of either shut down in progress or canceled because of security risks. I mean, we had previously reported about, you know, some activists, including, you know, somebody who's an avowed Proud Boy member, some folks who were allegedly threatening elected officials and you know, doing a lot of other things that were really kind of questionable. We reported that. And then there was, you know, the existing board was saying that they've been getting threatened by these people. They canceled it for the security threat. They've been sued by that group. There's an ongoing lawsuit in this matter because, you know, now that group is saying they were discriminated against when they weren't allowed into these meetings and stuff. And it's just, it really is a mess. And the two things that, you know, aren't really part of the mudslinging and the drama that I think are terribly important are those two things that I just mentioned, which is essentially, you know, the tons of rank and file Republicans who just, they want to be part of the party. They want to, you know, listen to how they're going to get the Democrats. They want to, you know, do the work and organize and volunteer and things like that. And all these candidates who, you know, in Nevada, almost all the Republicans running are challengers to entrenched incumbents because most of the elected officials here are Democrats, especially in Clark County. So they've already got this uphill battle of trying to beat somebody who's in office, which we've always said is always tough. Now they got to do it without much of a county party, and some have said, you know, maybe not much of a state party too, as it's so involved in this right now. So it's not a good look for Republicans, I would think. And I have gotten a number of emails just from readers who are like, I wish they'd sort it out so we could get focused on getting rid of these Democrats, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's definitely a prevailing sentiment.
Well, there's also the irony attached here because you have a lot of these folks. Jesse Law has on his Twitter, or had on his Twitter last time I checked, a identification badge. It showed him as going down to the Arizona election audit. Michael McDonald has alleged that there was, you know, voter fraud here in Nevada, and they've questioned the results of the 2020 election. And now they find themselves involved in an election that is itself questioned. And so there's a thick coating of irony on this whole thing. As I sit here right now, I can't tell you who is the legitimate Republican Party leadership. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how the bylaws are going to come out. I don't know, you know, if the NRS is applicable in any sense. I have no idea how the judge will rule on this question. And it may be one of these theoretical, you know, questions that never really gets resolved. But I think it's ironic that folks who have staked their ground on the issue of election integrity are now, you know, involved in an election that is being questioned within their own organization, not outside the organization. Because I think a lot of people outside are looking in, just kind of scratching their heads going, you know, what does this all mean? It's like people who are not Star Wars fans overhearing a debate about whether Han or Greedo shot first. and thinking, you know, the emotional investment that people make in that debate is something to which they can't relate. Now, of course, in contradiction to the Republican question, we all know the truth of that other one is that Han indeed shot first.
Yep.
And
yep.
That's the yep. only way it's going to be. And
that
so,
is the only way. It's canon.
It is canon. And and so, but in the Republican sense, a lot of people on the outside looking in are thinking, you know, what is going on here? What are these guys doing? First, they're saying the election that was run and certified and blessed by courts is wrong, but now they're getting involved in an election that their own people say is wrong. It's almost overwhelming irony. And believe me, politics in the modern era tips the irony scale on a regular basis, and so this is just adding to the gravity of that and the quantum singularity that's slowly forming around our planet as a result of all this irony may someday suck us into the non-existence. But I think what you said before is really the heart of the issue. There is bad blood, animosity between Michael McDonald and the former chairman of the Clark County Republican Party. And there's a lot of people, you know, in Republican circles that don't really like Michael McDonald, but they're frustrated because Michael McDonald is the longest serving chairman of the party. They have been trying to take him out. They targeted him once with political consultant Robert Eitoven as an alternative. He was backed by no less a personage than Sheldon Adelson, the late former chairman of Las Vegas Sands, whose family continues to own the Review Journal and this podcast. And he lost. They lost that race, notwithstanding the resources and the blessing of Mr. Adelson. So I think there's a good degree of frustration within the party about Michael McDonald's continued chairmanship. But with the endorsement of President Trump, the personal endorsement of President Trump, there's no way they're going to knock him off. And there's a sense that Michael McDonald, as a result of that personal endorsement from Trump, has an outsized influence on not only the state party, but also the county parties. And there's some resentment, I think, on those levels for that, because there's some disagreement as to whether or not the path forward for Republicans involves Donald Trump or does not. And so that still has to get worked out. In the meantime, I suppose the Republicans should probably be happy that this is happening in July going into August of 2021 and not July going into August of 2022 when they're, you know, supposed to be about the business of registering and turning out voters, because this would be a huge distraction in that sense. And the Republicans do not need any further distractions. Here in Clark County, the Clark County Republican Party has been surpassed in voter registration by independent voters. And that is not a good thing. As you pointed out, every statewide office but one is held by a Democrat. And by the way, the state party censured the one remaining Republican who oversaw the election and did her job very well, but not to their satisfaction. So there's a lot of dysfunction and there's a lot of problems and a lot of hurdles in the way of the organized Republican Party to win back some of these seats, to try to defeat Governor Sisolak or defeat Senator Cortez Masto, win back seats in the legislature. And so they don't need any additional speed bumps in the on the highway to success. And this certainly is a big one because, you know, this court fight, it's not like you go on the people's court and 30 minutes later you have your verdict. This could take a while. This could easily bleed certainly into the fundraising that begins toward the latter part of this year, but maybe even into next year. We may come to New Year's Eve and not know who the real leaders of the Republican Party are.
Absolutely. And you mentioned the irony of the whole election thing. And this is, I mean, Jesse Law, as well as some of the central committee members who form the quorum, I noticed, and we put in our story that Alita Benson is an example. She's the current political director at the state party. But those two specifically, when it was time for the state Republican Party and the Trump campaign to, when they were contesting the election results and they were collecting all these, you know, these input, those two were directly involved with that process. They were the ones, you know, along with, you know, Rory McShane, the consultant, and some others who were physically putting together the collecting of these testimonials and things like that. And they were also part of, and I don't know, I had, maybe I had blocked this from memory, but I think they were also part of that fake electoral college meeting that they staged as well. They well, first of all, the people who would have been electors for Trump, they had sued, basically trying to get a court to say, yeah, you know, Joe Biden didn't win the election in the state. We should be the electors. Let us go to the convention, all that sort of stuff. But then they, when they didn't win that, they went up to Carson City, I think it was. I don't think it was down here. They went up to Carson City and basically held a meeting outside and like in a, I guess in like a mock ceremony, but they, you know, they took it quite seriously.
Oh yeah.
All cast their ballots for Trump as electors. And I think, yeah. I think they were all part of that as well.
They were, it was, group. It was rogue electors and it was out in front mm-hmm. of the legislative building and it was a big show because there was a thinking that if in fact a court did invalidate the election, a long shot that never came to pass. But if a court did do that, they needed to act by the deadline so that they would have their alternative electors ready to go and cast the state's electoral votes for Donald Trump as opposed to Joe Biden, who actually won the election. And so they did, by the deadline, do that, sign their names to fake forms that they printed out, and it was not blessed by the Secretary of State. It was not official proceeding, but they did it, you know, in order both, I think, to comment on their view of the election's integrity, but also to preserve some perceived legal right in the event that, you know, things went their way, which of course they did not. So yeah, there's still a lot of dispute over that and whatnot. And now there's dispute over, you know, the election to their own organization. At some point you really have to wonder, you know, when the garden variety political party dysfunction that you see in both Republican and Democratic parties, where they fight with each other because that's just something they enjoy doing. These parties become debating societies and they fight with each other at these meetings. When that bleeds over to the effectiveness of the organization, you know, what do regular folks who are registered with the party, what do they do at this point? You know, they are living their lives. They're not paying attention to any of this. They see the stories. They hear the rumors of what's going on. They just don't know what to make of it. And a lot of people, I think even people inside the party are in that same boat. They don't know what to make of it either. And I have some sympathy for them and in their plight about this. So it'll be interesting to see. As I said, I am not envious of the judge who is eventually going to decide this case. And I wish them good luck.
Watch your DVR Nevada Newsmakers Saturday and Sunday mornings from 5:30 to 6:30 on Cox Cable Channel 12 or Dish and Direct TV Channel 21 or anytime at NevadaNewsmakers.com.
I'm Jeff Gehrman, an investigative reporter with the Las Vegas Review-Journal. I'm your guide for season 2 of Mobbed Up, The Fight for Las Vegas.
You're in with every gangster and hoodlum in the United States.
I don't go for that, Mr. Kennedy. I don't go for that kind of action.
I was on television accused of fronting for the mob.
Subscribe to Mobbed Up, The Fight for Las Vegas, Season 2, today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And the other, like, aside to all this is there may very well be another one of these dances in the next, like, month or two, because it's typically around late August, early September when there's a new state party chair election. And Michael McDonald is running for re-election. He has gotten that Trump endorsement. And I believe he has some challengers. I think the former, I can't recall his name at the time, but the former Washoe County Republican Party chair, I think, is running against him. And you know, when this happened in 2019, there were a few others. We had Annie Black and I can't remember the other couple too. But the point is that they might, the Republicans in this area maybe end up be doing this dance again.
Yeah, at the and state the other level. And the other faction of the party has a meeting scheduled, I believe it's August 17th.
They do, for sure.
For another election. So yes. at that point, probably before, because you know, the people who are in charge of the party need control of the checkbook and then the keys to the office and all
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
But probably, if not before then, certainly after that election, there will be an actual controversy, in fact, of who is in charge of this party. And yes. so the lawsuit can thus, you know, proceed. I don't think it's ripe at this point because you know, there's contentions on the one side. But once you have a slate of election and a vote count for one group and a slate of election and a vote count for another group, then I think it's ripe for a court to weigh in and see what's going to happen. So some lawyers will make some money off of this, but I don't know if anyone else will benefit.
For sure. And the county party, as it existed at least a couple of days ago and seems to exist now, the holdover sort of board has already started sending stuff out, and they're planning to exclude Jesse Law. They basically have said Jesse Law has been involved in legal action against this party. He's criticized us publicly. He's done a number of things in which we've decided as a board to suspend his membership, and thus as a suspended member, he can't run. They've got, again, you know, some personal, some, you know, I don't know, you know, kind of some drama there, basically. And essentially they've sent out stuff to three of the other candidates, including Carrie Buck, the state senator who's running. And she, I've basically heard, wasn't at the other group's meeting night before. I don't know if she was considered or if she was voted on or whatever, but I guess she had decided to boycott that previous meeting. So you've also got these two dueling elections that had apparently different candidates in them, like some candidates, you know. So I, again, whatever judge is going to have to sort through that, and we certainly mentioned, you know, the toll that this takes on current Republicans running, and that's the second thing that we wanted to talk about, you know, for the last little bit of the show this week. Is essentially, I did interview a couple of the candidates who are running in the 3rd District, in Susie Lee's district, the most competitive district in Nevada, what will likely still be the most competitive district even after redistricting. We were able to talk to a couple of them. Obviously, we had previously done a story on April Becker, who is an attorney. She has she declared a couple of months ago. She previously ran for state Senate, lost very narrowly to the Senate Majority Leader, Nicole Cannizzaro. She has since been raising some pretty good money. She's raised almost $400,000 as of the end of June. And again, typically in this area, I mean, the fundraising hasn't really started. A lot of people are still getting in and, you know, hiring a team and things like that. So she's got a pretty good head start on two of these folks that we talked to, and I'll just sort of get into each of them here. The first one that I talked to, his name is John Kovacs, and he is a civil engineer. He's a construction – he owns a construction company here, a couple of construction companies here in Nevada. He also is from New Jersey originally. He's got a construction company there. He's being represented by Eitoven, who you mentioned. That's, you know, all of the big political consultants in this area. I think except for Red Rock, have a candidate in this race so far. He's the Eitoven candidate. And, you know, I did speak to him. He's never ran for office before. He's a businessman. I mean, he was pretty, you know, set on, you know, we need to be, you know, better at business, you know, things like that. He really didn't have a whole lot of political things to say, to be perfectly honest. It is one of his really sort of niche kind of issues that was interesting to me was water. He's a civil engineer, and he was basically saying, you know, somebody needs to do something about the water. You know, we're running out of water. The reservoirs all in Arizona, in Nevada, that all, you know, service this area are at their lowest. And that's true. That's, we've been reporting that, you know, at the RJ for these last couple of weeks. They've hit all time or long time sort of lows. Pretty much, you know, every week there's been a new reservoir that's at a low in this area. So it's interesting because he's talking about things like, you know, desalination and you know, building more storage. He kind of blended a lot of Democratic and Republican issues or positions on that particular issue of water storage, conservation, things like that. He was really kind of all over the place politically on that because, again, he's not really a politician. I mean, he's an engineer and somebody who builds things and is a construction contractor and things like that. So it is worth a look, I think. We had the story posted a week ago. So it was from last Thursday. So it's online if you want to go and look for him. It's, you know, under my byline. You can search for me or search for him. That's, he's on the one side. And then the other one that I talked to for a bit was a little bit more sort of political in his answers and you know, where he wants to go. His name's Noah Malgieri, and he's a lawyer around here. He's also owns a business. He's also an engineer, and he's an Iraq war veteran as well. And that's kind of his story. He was a little bit more, you know, Democrats are corrupt. You know, people are getting policed, you know, social media companies are restricting free speech. He was a little bit more red meat in his kind of approach for the Republicans. He is being represented by Rory McShane's group. So that's their group. Abel Becker, we should say too, is also, he's part of the Mike Slanger, November Inc. So everybody, all the sort of biggish political consultants in the state have a dog in this race very, very early. He was a little bit more, he was concerned about China. He's, you know, former soldier who was involved in the Iraq war. He was a JAG officer, things like that. A little bit more of a typical kind of political background in that he's a soldier, he's a lawyer, small business owner, that kind of jives with somebody who's running as a Republican. But it does seem, you know, it's very, very early. They haven't started raising money. The field is probably going to grow even further, but it does seem at this very, very early juncture that with $400,000 in the bank, pretty good name recognition from running a big race last time and the support of, you know, November Inc. and everything like that, it does seem Becker is doing pretty well. There is another candidate who we're trying to get an interview with. His name's Mark Robertson. He's a retired Army officer and small businessman as well. He's has a consultant based out of Utah who's running. So there's at least four that we know of, and I would expect there's probably going to be more, and it could be a pretty knockdown, drag-out primary because, you know, like I said, they're all represented by pretty serious consultants around here who like to win primaries and like to, you know, would love to be the one to topple Susie Lee as well, who is probably quite thrilled about this very large field that I've already, if you read my stories on both of them, have already started to kind of rend each other on the way to getting to her. So it's going to be an interesting race.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, CD3 is now and has always represented the Republicans' best chance to win a seat in Congress in the Las Vegas area. CD4, which has been held by a Republican before, it's a little more iffy. The registration is a little more advantageous to Democrats. CD3 was drawn 20 years ago as a competitive district, and it has remained a competitive district since then. Ironically enough, one of the authors of that district and one of the people who kind of, I think, saw how it was going to grow over the next decade is Mike Slanker, who is the consultant for April Becker. And with all due respect to the other candidates, I would have to say April Becker at this point is the front runner. And I say that for three reasons. One, obviously the money that she has raised so far. But two, her name recognition was really boosted by that race against Nicole Catanzaro. And that's really comes to the third category, which is political experience. She has actually been out there on the campaign trail. She has gone through everything a candidate goes through, raising money, calling strangers and asking for money, probably the worst thing you have to do to run for politics, forming policy positions, talking to the media, talking to various groups to try to secure people's vote, doing all the candidate things that are probably going to come as either surprises or they're going to be navigating for the first time all these other candidates, those things. It's not to say that the race is in the bag, not at all. But certainly April Becker, I think, has a head start, not just in fundraising. I think she has a head start politically as well. She did very well against Nicole Cannizzaro, which that district was very tight. That race was very close. And Cannizzaro beat her by a very narrow margin. That would have been, had April Becker succeeded there, it would have been like capturing your opponent's queen in a chess game. I mean, she is the majority leader in the state Senate, and had Republicans captured that seat, that would have been quite a feather in their cap. Susie Lee would also be a very good feather in the Republicans' cap. They really want that. That seat has been held by Republicans, John Porter, Joe Heck, over the years, and they really want that seat back. And I think it's a good idea to nominate somebody who is maybe not necessarily known as a fire-breathing partisan. The last time, Susie Lee was very fortunate. She got a opponent who was former pro wrestler, and did his best. Wasn't the best candidate that they could have chosen for that seat, but that's who won the primary. And she did very well on election day. So. And then her later opponent went on to run in Texas and produce probably one of the most comical ads, most head-turning transformations I've seen in politics in many, many years. But we will leave Dan Rodheimer in the mists of history. I will say this, though. I was very intrigued in your story with John Kovacs, because I think whether it's because he's an engineer or whether it's just because he's an intelligent guy, he has put his finger on probably the number one issue facing Southern Nevada, and that is the water issue. That is the issue upon which all of the other issues, the very existence of this city, depend. Everything else, all the economic development initiatives that we are trying to pursue, home building and home costs, everything is dependent on water. And I'm going to have a column coming up on this, a little preview coming up, not this week, but the following week, on the water issue and how the water district is working to meet the growth projections. And we have environmentalists on the other side saying we just can't grow that much. This is the key issue. The water issue. And so it was intriguing to me to find a candidate who picked that issue out of all the other issues. You know, you're a member of Congress, so it's a federal issue. So you have immigration, you have foreign policy, you have domestic policy, you have deficit hawk versus somebody who's not that concerned about the national debt. You have entitlement programs, healthcare, all of that. But this one issue, that really stood out to me, and that's unique. You don't see that very often. In fact, I don't think another candidate for Congress has made that even a tiny part of their campaign in all the years I've covered politics. So I was really intrigued by John Kovacs' position on that, and I think, and I hope he keeps talking about it, because it is something that needs to be addressed. The water district assures me that we have enough water for not only the projected growth, but even a little bit more. They're actually a little more liberal in their projections of how many people are going to move here, and they're planning to meet those needs going into the future. But that's just the one thing I think that that people here, they don't talk about enough, and they don't understand. I learned things when I was doing research for that column. So I think it's intriguing. I hope Mr. Kovacs continues with his discussion of that issue and bringing attention to that issue, because I think it's a really important one.
It really was. And I'm going to read just the quote that he gave me here that I thought was very succinct in terms of, you know, when he sent out his, you know, initially, all these candidates, they always send out a launch video that they bring out. There's usually an announcement, and the announcements you know, and it's just the same thing happened with Joe Lombardo running for governor. A lot of them hit on the same kind of key things. Critical race theory is a big one right now. Mm-hmm. That's just a buzz thing. But defending the Second Amendment, limiting taxes, you know, everybody hits on the same thing in that initial. It's a really a shotgun approach of things. And he did that too. But then when I actually spoke to the man, he gave me this exact quote, which, and this is talking about the water situation. It's not as sexy as the election fraud or critical race theory or the Second Amendment. But if this area didn't have water, it'd be a ghost town. And that's absolutely true. No, there's nobody can question that at all. I think it is. Yeah. I think both things are true, that for a Republican running for office, it isn't as sexy as those things, for sure. Because I can tell you, every Republican I've talked to in the last 2 months who's announced for a race has mentioned those other three things pretty much. And then he goes on, and I really wanted to spell this out in the story. He goes on to even say maybe they need a moratorium. Maybe they need to stop the local building projects and the expansion until they can refill these reservoirs. And this is somebody who's a contractor who that's taking money out of his pocket, essentially, that type of plan, because he is himself a builder. And so to suggest that, I thought, was really interesting. And he did say in the interview that would be a key issue going forward, that he was going to produce, you know, I don't know if it was a mailer or literature. He said there's going to be some stuff coming out from his campaign on that specific issue. He called it what he put and what I put in the story. He basically said, that's me scribbling it out on the back of a cocktail napkin for you. He's like, we're eventually going to, you know, explain specifically, this is exactly how I would want to do these things, which I thought, wow, that'd be pretty interesting and pretty sort of unusual for somebody running for office who's never run before and is, you know, such an early part of the campaign. So I do think that's interesting. And it did definitely stick out among the field. I mean, I think you're right about Becker. It's going to be tough. And I think, you know, and we mentioned this in the story too. I mean, Susie Lee is now, she's beaten off, you know, sort of national support for a Republican challenger in two straight races now. She was, you know, won pretty comfortably, given how it was close, but it was when you look at the makeup of that district and how it voted in presidential elections, for example. I mean, that was in 2016, that was a Trump district that she won as a Democrat. So, you know, I think she's done very well. I think she's going to have a number of legislative accomplishments to point to. She's somebody who at every turn, every time you talk to her, is talking about, like, you know, pragmatic solutions and nonpartisan solutions and, you know, I'm sorry, bipartisan solutions, things like that. She was a support of, you know, this apparent infrastructure compromise that's, you know, as we're recording, is apparently moving through the machinations. There might actually be something in terms of a $1 trillion infrastructure plan, things like that. I mean, she's been on that, which is something you got to do in a swing district like that. And she's also raising plenty of money, going to have plenty of national support herself. So, you know, I mean, these Republicans, they've got a tough task in terms of, you know, getting through a primary, because it seems like it's going to be crowded with a lot of, you know, big name kind of political minds here, you know, orchestrating these campaigns. And then, you know, Susie Lee's waiting for you after that. So yeah. It'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see. And obviously, this is one of the races that we're going to be taking very, very careful look at and a long look at for months to come.
Yep, absolutely.
Great. Great. Well, I think that's probably enough for this week. I'm certain, given the last few days of my life, that there'll probably be more updates on this Clark County Republican Party thing for next week's episode, but we'll see. Certainly, there's always something going on, and we'll certainly find that. As always, you can find us both on social media, on Twitter at Rory Desphonics, at Steve Sebelius, wherever you're listening right now. Make sure you like and subscribe. You know, send us a review if you'd like. And yeah, that's probably enough for this week. I'm politics reporter Rory Appleton.
And I'm politics and government editor Steve Sebelius.
Watch your DVR Nevada Newsmakers Saturday and Sunday mornings from 5:30 to 6:30 on Cox Cable Channel 12 or Dish and Direct TV Channel 21 or anytime at NevadaNewsmakers.com.
I'm Jeff Gehrman, an investigative reporter with the Las Vegas Review-Journal. I'm your guide for season two of Mobbed Up, The Fight for Las Vegas.
You're in with every gangster and hoodlum in the United States.
I don't go for that, Mr. Kennedy. I don't go for that kind of action.
I was on television accused of fronting for the mob.
Subscribe to Mobbed Up, The Fight for Las Vegas, Season 2, today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.